Hello, I'm Mr. Movies of the Famous Film. Hello, I'm Mr. Movies of the Famous Film Twitter.com, and this is the Mr. Movies Podcast.
Welcome to the world of doom. Wouldn't it be a shame if I put worms all up in your spice? Look at that there. See that spice over there? Boom. There's worms in it now. Does the scent behind me make you feel more at ease or more anxious? Both? Good. Because there's worms in everything now. Like a sick dog at the vet.
I've got worms.
This is very serious, though. As you and I bend through space and time, I take you through the exciting world of worms being all up in your shit.
That's interesting.
All right. So it's about time. It is 73 episodes into the podcast. And I finally had Alyssa on to talk about the most movie of all time. Dune. How do you feel about this movie?
So I definitely would not say that I love this movie. I have a healthy, almost respect and fear of this movie. I think it's the most inhospitable to the audience movie I've ever seen in my life.
Yeah. I started getting a feeling that David Lynch hated us at one point. He's like, because the project, as a film, the first hour of Dune is, like, legitimately great filmmaking. And then something happens. I can't tell you what it is. I can't put my finger on it. But at some point, David Lynch said, you know what? Fuck you. And I really respect that.
Yeah, it's a very interesting failure in a way that I haven't seen a lot of recent movies fail. And for that, you know, it's really compelling.
Yeah, because, like, we were just talking about this off mic, but I mean, like, I never want to have a podcast or really, like, a conversation where I'm like, here's everything wrong with, you know, like, whatever movie. There's a lot that this movie offers that's genuinely great. It's genuinely fun, playful filmmaking. But it's also one of those movies that literally falls into that category of so bad that it's good.
Yeah.
Like, it's fascinating. It's like watching a rhino gore something at a zoo. You know? It's just like, you can't take your eyes off of it. This movie made me realize two things, which is, one, and it's a thing that I think both of us agree on, Dune is unfilmable. We will never have a good Dune movie. And two, is that we were absolutely robbed by not getting Jodorowsky's legendary 10-hour Dune movie. And we talked about this a little bit before. How much do you know about his proposed project?
I know that he, it was going to cost like $13 billion in the form that he wanted for it.
Yep. That is very true. Among those were, so he created a storyboard that was 3,000 pictures big, which is obscenely huge. That does not happen.
Yeah.
Salvador Dali was slated to play the Baron, and he asked for $100,000 per hour to act in the movie, and Jodorowsky offered to pay him $100,000 per minute. but Dolly could be in no more than 3 to 5 minutes of the movie. Supposedly, the production company said that, like, you have to cut down the length of the film if you're ever going to make this, and that is the reason it fell apart. It looked like Jodorowsky had so much of a pull that he was pretty much allowed to do whatever he wanted, and even then, he couldn't pull his head out of his ass long enough to realize that he, like, literally just his inability to cut back kind of ruined his chances. He also said that, like, Orson Welles was going to be in the movie, and Michael Jackson was supposedly going to be in the movie. He talked about, like, his, when he was, like, talking about the novel, the other thing that he said was that he really liked Marcel Proust, which is, like, probably another reason why they didn't make it. They're like, oh, it's going to be one of those movies. This really is going to be 14 hours long.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, maybe that's if you are gonna do proper justice to Dune, maybe it does need to be that long.
It literally does. Like just the first book, the amount of information that's in it. So have you read Dune?
Yeah, I read Dune once, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, after trying to get into it for 2 or 3 sit downs, it finally took, and I remember having to make myself work a little bit to finish it, but I finished that and I read Dune Messiah after that, and they're pretty good. Once you get past the all the jargon, it's a pretty engaging story if you're into that genre.
Yeah, it's that like exploratory sci-fi that I genuinely love.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely formal, and I guess it's what you would call hard science fiction. So,
oh, for sure, yeah.
I don't think it's necessarily for everyone, but I did like the the grandeur of the time scale of the story and how cold and elevated everything was.
I like that. The thing that, like, really sold me with Dune is that Frank Herbert, as he was, like, writing it, he just assumed that we're all on the same level as him.
Yeah.
Like, this, it's so frustrating because, like, the movie does this, and I'm going to mention that, like, throughout as we, like, talk about it, but, like, the show don't tell aspect of filmmaking is, like, it's a thing that I hold nearest and dearest to my heart. Like, yeah. I would rather leave a movie a little bit confused than be like, I'm really happy that the main character stopped, looked dead in the camera, and went, hey, Harry, so this part of the movie, it's going to be real sad, so buckle up. Frank Herbert does that kind of with his book, where he's like, all right, so we all know that the spice is everything, right? It's like, the what?
We're good to proceed, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so this thing bends space-time. We all know what bending space-time is. Yeah, Frank. Sure. Why not? The other thing about the book that I love is the fact that Frank Herbert's politics are completely incoherent.
Oh, they're incoherent. Very interesting guy.
Yeah. It really does make sense that the story took the shape that it did, because in order to be pro divine right of kings and monarchy, but at the same time detest power completely, you have to be completely incoherent, and that's exactly what his political beliefs were. I was looking this up before this, and I was like, because I knew that, like, the Chapo guys had, like, talked about Frank Herbert, where they were like, I don't want an author with good politics, I want an author who makes no sense, and they're like, Frank Herbert is the king. And he was scared of communists, he hated the Soviet Union with his entire heart. He really loved McCarthy. He called Joseph McCarthy brother or Uncle Joe. I forget what the nomenclature was. And then all of a sudden also was like, and by the way, the Vietnam War is the most morally detestable thing we've ever done as a country.
Yeah, just a real mix of contradictions.
You know who he would be? He would be the marble bust avatar guy on Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
like being the devil's advocate, not just to be annoying, but because that is who he is.
Yeah, he's the embodiment of just that contrarian impulse above everything else.
Yeah. Like, he doesn't even want to be the smartest guy in the room. I don't even know what the word is.
Totally idiosyncratic in his beliefs. I have a note. I'm going back through my notes from when I was just writing down observations while watching the movie. House Harkonnen is literally just like an MMA gym where they do solo stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how I pictured it in the book, but it wasn't like that.
You weren't expecting, like, early 90s Berlin sex dungeon?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't expecting, like, everything to be so grimy and everyone to be so sweaty and just, ugh.
Yeah, that's... I'm gonna talk about this, like, in the recap, but, like, whenever things are wet, things are bad.
Mm-hmm.
That was, like, the one thing I noticed. Like, the wetter the scene is, the worse shit's about to get for everyone.
Yeah.
And that sex dungeon scene, whatever that was, that is the wettest scene in the movie. So, by proxy.
Yeah, that was deeply upsetting.
Yeah, the pulling the thing off the chest. Oh, my God.
I mean, yeah, it's upsetting for a few reasons, but, yeah. The blood stuff.
Oh, man, I can't wait. And I guess now is as good of a time as any. We were kind of, you know, flirting with this beforehand where it was like, do we just do like a general talk about Dune? You know, make sure that we don't step on any toes. Make sure that we like don't get like major details of the story wrong and upset people. But like, these are two of the most feral fan bases in the world, which are like people who like Dune and people who like David Lynch. And I think it'd be great to get a whole bunch of stuff wrong and have them get mad at me. So
yeah,
let's
absolutely.
Do a plot recap of Dune.
A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191. In this time, the most precious substance in the universe is the spice melange. The spice extends life. The spice exists on only one planet in the entire universe. The planet is Arrakis. Also known as Dune.
The movie opens up with a big floating head, the most Lynchian thing you can do in your movie. Damn, this is so surreal. This is like Twin Peaks meets The Sopranos. Am I right, Twitter? Up top.
I was trying the whole time to refrain from saying how Lynchian anything is. Because it's been beaten to death on Twitter. Everyone's sick of it. Everyone hates hearing Lynchian thrown around. But so many things in this movie are so Lynchian in that I think the first appearance or like the biggest budget appearance of so many motifs and themes that would become his signatures.
Oh yeah, goopy flesh.
Yeah,
severed heads. Horrific pulsing skin,
yep.
Which is like to me is like the Lynch signature.
Yeah, the sheer body horror.
It's so cool knowing that, like, I mean, like, we really are like blessed that Eraserhead happened. And I've been like very vocal about this on Twitter, and I know that not everybody who listens to this podcast is on Twitter, but like, my God, film Twitter and David Lynch, it like right now it is unbearable. It's so bad right now. It's kind of like how the site was with Martin Scorsese right as The Irishman was coming out.
Yeah.
Or Phantom Thread in 2017. Like, you just pick a topic and you beat the living shit out of it. That being said, Eraserhead is an absolute blessing. It deserves as much praise as it gets. And the opening of this movie feels like Eraserhead all grown up. Specifically in, like, what you talked about was, like, that grotesque body horror.
Yeah.
The lady in this intro gives us exactly what we need to know about this world. Mm-hmm. There's a substance called spice. What is spice? Well, spice is everything. Spice helps you space travel, and spice helps you expand your consciousness. We also get our stakes in this, which is that the spice only exists on one planet. That planet's called Arrakis, which is hostile. It's also called Dune, and they hold a belief that there is a prince that was promised that will lead them to salvation or something. I don't know. This plot recap's already going really poorly. I go insane for sand dunes, personally. I don't really know what it is. I love a desert in a movie. There's like a weird spiritual connection to it. Like, I think it's because like all my formative media when I was growing up, like Jack and Daxter. Deserts. Yeah, exactly. Mad Max. Like, all that stuff I just beat into my head and I was like, oh, that's what I want to do with my life. Looking back, glad I didn't. The wearing goggles with bandanas every day. I don't know. I guess
it's,
I was like
a pretty good
steampunk guy. Yeah.
It's always a good look.
Did you ever have a steampunk phase?
I did not.
Not even
that much I can claim that I, you know, I've done a lot of embarrassing things in my life, but I've never had a steampunk phase.
I had an ex-girlfriend, or at the time she was my girlfriend, but it was my ex-girlfriend when I was going to college. I was like telling her about steampunk and how cool it was. She thought it was like the lamest shit. And what was funny was we were on a bus and she like elbows me and points at a girl and she goes, "Is her top hat steampunk?"
Well, it's interesting how much of this movie seems to be informed by the steampunk aesthetic before it was really a thing.
Absolutely. It like really is formative.
Yeah.
Like the whole like there's like cyberpunk elements to it. There's diesel punk elements to it and like the churning, pluming smoke of the machinery. And everything is pipes with steam in it.
Yeah.
I hate being like, "Lynch, you visionary, you absolute legend," but like he nailed it.
Yeah, that felt very like on a continuum from Eraserhead.
God, Eraserhead's so fucking good. I want to do another episode of Eraserhead.
Of just Eraserhead.
Yeah. I've like already done one. I just want to do it again.
Oh, it's been so long since I've seen it.
That'd be really funny if like this whole time David Lynch has just like accidentally been doing surrealism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's just like, "Ah, yeah, it'd be really cool if his haircut was real tall and his socks got wet in the opening scene." And, you know, people are reading into it. They're like, "Oh, this is the mm-hmm. Industrial Revolution. This is the suburban sprawl." And he's just like, "It'd be funny if his socks were wet." You know, just Midwestern grit.
Whereas there's very little in Dune that's not text. There's really nothing subtextual you can take away from it.
Absolutely. Because
I think like maybe 45% of the movie is narration, if not more.
Oh yeah, it really does feel like he bit off like way more than he could chew with this movie. Where it
yeah.
was like the first hour is just phenomenal filmmaking. It's so good. That
yeah,
first
it's,
hour.
Yeah, it's pretty tightly structured, but I think you can see the seams where either he lost control of the project or where the executive stepped in and meddled.
Yeah, I like to think that this movie was going to be like 4 or 5 hours long.
Yeah.
Because had it followed that pace, it probably would have been a great film.
Yeah, you can see where they started trying to reel it in.
Yeah.
And you can see the decisions they made to try to expedite things. And it's weird because I felt throughout the whole thing, like, there was both too much and not enough narration, and the narration didn't cover the right things, and they just dumped information on you, but it just was overwhelming.
Yeah, the world building that you have to do for this movie, for literally anything to make sense, is like, it's like such a massive undertaking. And because there's like never been a Dune movie before, you know, mm-hmm. you're the guy setting it in motion.
Yeah, there's this huge expectation on you.
Yeah, absolutely, like an impossible task. Because I'm just imagining like that we still have to like rehash like Batman's parents dying like
yeah.
every two movies. It's like, so we all remember. We remember they died outside the opera. We all remember that. You know, and it's like, you couldn't do that with Dune. So he just, I really do think David Lynch and like crew really did try their best.
Yeah, you can see that it was a labor of love for people. And I think it was probably the best cast you could have asked for. I thought pretty much everyone did a really amazing job and people clearly read the text.
Yeah, it has me really worried about Denis Villeneuve's Dune.
Yeah.
Because like, I don't know. Dune to me almost is like kind of like a silly story. And I know people get mad at that or whatever, but I mean, like, there's big worms and there's spice that makes your brain go all big. Like, it's kind of funny. And there's, like, kind of like a silliness to Lynch's cinema that feels appropriate, you know, just kind of, like, the ridiculous grandeur of the spectacle of it all.
Yeah.
That, like, Denis Villeneuve's movies are, like, so serious and, like, oh, it's overcast and I'm frowning, you know? And it's, like, I have no hopes, is, like, what I'm getting at. I think we're all going to leave that first movie, and it's just going to be, like, well, guess next year we get to find out what happens to him.
Yeah, I remembered that it was going to be, it's going to be divided into two parts, which is probably smart.
Yeah, that's, yeah, like, based on 100% the right move. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I'm optimistic about how he's going to handle it. Because I think that I am sort of neutral on Blade Runner 2049, but
interesting.
I liked Arrival. Yeah, I know. People get really up in arms about anything Blade Runner related.
Explain yourself, ma'am.
in the hot seat.
All I did was I took to the timeline. I said Blade Runner is Among Us, but if it was in the 80s, and everyone got all angry.
Yeah, I would need to see Blade Runner 2049 again to consolidate my opinion on it, because I fell asleep.
Oh, really? That's pretty gangster.
So I don't think that I have a trustworthy opinion right now.
You paid like $14 for a nap.
I respect
that. This bourgeois aristocracy.
Sorry, Harrison Ford.
God, what a shoehorned reference. That really, like, when I saw Harrison Ford was in the movie, I was like, come on.
And I like that he didn't even really try.
Yeah, he, like, wore the t-shirt that he slept in.
Yeah, he's Harrison Ford. He's over this shit.
Yeah, he, like, survived a plane crash, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's in borrowed time right now. He doesn't give a shit. And I respect him for it. Before we kick off the rest of this plot recap, how did that Brian Eno soundtrack make you feel?
When it wasn't completely distracting, it was really good, but it was also really distracting.
Yeah, the theme song. What's funny was, like, I have my headphones on and I'm just, like, kind of watching it, you know, kind of half paying attention, and then he just blares the theme song. It's the loudest thing in the whole movie. It's really funny because there's a scene where, like, the worm screams, mm-hmm. and they're like, oh, it's so deafening, but you can barely hear it. And, like, the Brian Eno theme song is so loud that you will, like, audibly let out an ouch.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's that loud.
Yeah, the Brian Eno and Toto collaboration that all of the 80s have been building towards.
Yeah, this movie really should have been, like, a magnum opus, and it just looks like a production studio just meddled.
Yeah.
All throughout this movie, there's a whole lot of factionalist racial strife, I think you could call it.
Yeah.
That's very explicitly talked about this entire movie. Like, at the beginning of the movie, a bunch of bald cretins demand that the Bene Jesuit, I think is what she was called?
Yeah.
Priest needed to leave. This is because there are a whole lot of planets all throughout the Duneverse, and naturally, the high aristocracy is at odds with a lot of the people involved with getting dust spice. The thing that stands out the most to me in the next scene is the fact that essentially everything is practical effects, which made this movie age way better than it had any business doing. You know, like, that freakish worm thing with the pulsing nose and the creepy eyes and the, you know, the fog coming out as it breathes. Like, we talked about how cliche it is to call stuff Lynchian, but, I mean, look at him.
There were so many chasms opening up, and so many orifices, like, so many mouths.
It's so wet, it's so slimy, it's just like, yeah, of course you made that. Why wouldn't you spend half the budget constructing that?
Yeah, I really think that he connected very hard with the implied elemental body horror of the novels.
The thing that, like, got me was, like, there's, like, a lot of, like, surreal elements to those novels where it's, like, you're traveling through space and time without moving. You know, mm-hmm. this is a lot of, like, open up your third eye stuff.
Yeah.
But, like, also, the way that they describe a lot of these people's bodies in the books is, like, horrific.
Oh,
and
yeah.
if there's, like, any direct... It's, like, either David Lynch or Rob Zombie. Like, I don't know who else could do this well.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting for books that are so often very cold and mannered. There's a lot of physicality.
You are transparent. I see many things. I see plans within plans. I see two great houses. House Atreides. House Harkonnen Feudi. I see you behind it.
Yes.
You must share with us.
Like this monster, this, what I wrote in my notes is baby from Eraserhead all grown up, but then I remembered the baby from Eraserhead does get all grown up. he wears a suit in one scene.
Yeah.
he speaks of a prophecy that a Paul Atreides is looking real nice. Something about him, I don't know, everything's real cryptic. Which takes us to Paul himself, sitting and being a fucking nerd. It's Kyle MacLachlan. Which made me realize Kyle MacLachlan has looked like he's 42 years old his entire life.
Pretty much.
Like, he came out the womb with a mortgage. Which, I'm sure I spelled Kyle MacLachlan wrong in my notes. Wait, I don't need to tell you guys that. You aren't reading this, I am. This is where the movie, to me, feels like it took on so much more than it actually could do. The amount of knowledge that you have to know before going in for this stuff to make any sense or hold any sort of tangible weight is like so much information you have to cram into so little time. But given that aspect of it, he did a reasonably good job meandering between the people who don't know a single thing about the world, you know, conveying the stakes for folks like me who can't remember reading the book. And also throwing a few bones to the people who got upper-level degrees in herpetology. The big thing you learn from this is that the worms hate vibrations, which is way too easy of a joke. I will not make a joke that easy for the people who listen to this podcast, because I respect them too much. Which cuts to the most vaginal-looking ring of all time. I was stunned. I let out an audible, like, whoa. You know what I'm talking about, right? The seal?
Yeah.
I was like, how did he get away with that? Again, like, there's a real chance David Lynch is just doing this stuff and it just lines up in a way that you could just kind of interpret these things. But there's, like, a psychosexual pathology to Frank Herbert's writing.
Yeah.
And the opening of this, I mean, the drilling of the earth, the worms, that ring seal. Frank Herbert, to me, is pure, unbridled psychosexual rage. And again, if David Lynch intended this, he is one of the greatest living filmmakers. And if not, holy shit, what a home run.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's part of why this movie is so stressful, is because you're being bombarded with these images of just primal sexual psychosis.
It really is. It's almost like to a rage level, you know? Because
yeah.
It's like the ring is, it's only something that the men can use. And like the worms, just that symbology being like, that is the grandest power in this entire world. And the ability to crush anything that gets within its grasp. Like, it really does feel like this is probably exactly what Frank Herbert believed.
Yeah. I had in my notes from the very opening scene of the movie in the throne room that everyone just looks really scared.
Yeah.
And that impression just stayed with me for the rest of the movie. Like, everyone is scared.
Yeah.
Everyone's scared of the malevolent sexual energy of everything around them.
Yeah. And I know that this is coming across like we're riffing. We're being, like, completely serious. Like,
yeah.
That is a very, very prominent theme throughout this entire movie. Is, like, I think that you could argue in some scenes just, like, blatant sexual assault, and if not, allegories for it.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, you could even extend beyond that, where it's like, you know, the treatment of the earth. Like, I'm probably going to beep this word out, but like the earth that is like talked about by like environmentalists. That literally is like a major plot point of this movie. It's like nature fighting back for that. But then there's also like that imagery that we associate with the act of destroying the planet. I don't know. Maslow was right.
Well, then like you get to the Harkonnen stuff, and it takes on a whole new dimension.
Yeah. To juxtapose this, we get that knife shield training.
Yeah.
Which turns both Sir Patrick Stewart and Kyle MacLachlan into Roblox characters. That scene, what's funny to me is like, and an ongoing thing that I talk way too much about is like, so not all CGI is bad. The best CGI that you'll ever see is CGI you don't notice. Like Mad Max Fury Road has wonderful CGI. Those canyons are not built like that, but you're completely blind to them. But CGI, like this like knife shield training stuff, what's crazy is like, whenever you rely on that as like a crux of like a plot point in your movie, it's dated the second it comes out. You know?
Yeah, and this just, it looks like it was added in post.
Yeah, like an afterthought almost.
Yeah, I mean, that goes for a lot of the graphics and a lot of the effects, but it has a certain ugly charm to it. I found myself liking the shields more this time around than the first time I saw them, because this time I noticed the texture and the way that their faces moved under them, and I don't know, I thought it was cool.
Yeah, it probably was like groundbreaking technology at the time too.
Oh yeah,
like they follow their bodies. That had to have been like only the CIA had access to it, you know, until like 1984.
It's funny because I was reading a little bit about things that the 1984 Dune established that then became absorbed into future works. And if you watch the trailer to the Villeneuve one, they have similar shields. They have force fields. They're fighting in force fields. So
God,
obviously,
that's so good.
So obviously, like that's something that got absorbed through osmosis into people's idea of what Dune looks like. For all its flaws, like this movie had a big impact. Yeah, and the way that the sandworms look and act.
Yeah, it's insane. Like the fact that like the sandworms, the ones that we see like in the Denis Villeneuve trailer, they're almost just like drills. Have you noticed that? They're like perfect circles, and they have like that the maelstrom teeth from like Greek mythology or Roman mythology. I forget which one it is.
Yeah, they're very scary.
Yeah, but with this, they're just, I don't know. It's there's something about it that's George Lucas borrowed from Dune for that one meteor creature, the one where they like step out and they find out they're in its mouth. But like, I don't know. It's this stuff is like, as goofy as it seems, it really is like formative to the genre as a whole.
Yeah, I think a lot of essential sci-fi things came from this movie. When I say that I don't exactly love it, but I have a perverse admiration for it, I admire that it made such an impact on things that came after while also being a disaster.
Yeah, it's the disaster aspect is like kind of like the hook, but there is a lot in this movie that is like not only like worth studying but just like genuinely celebrating. And I think that like two completely mad men coming together and just kind of like, I don't know, like a mind like Frank Herbert and a mind like David Lynch coming to a head and producing something like this in the only genre that lets you behave like this is, it's, we gotta celebrate this stuff. It's great.
Yeah.
As bad as it is, it's great.
Yeah, it feels remarkable. It's, you know, it's inaccessible, but in a way that nothing else is really allowed to be anymore.
It's almost depressing, right?
Yeah.
Where it's like, movies now are, it's The Dark Knight, but with sandworms. It's The Dark Knight, or Inception, but there's a Mexican drug cartel.
Yeah.
You know, it's everything is overcast. Everything is gritty. Everything is very serious. Everyone has catchphrases. And nobody wants to play with They Worm in the Sand anymore.
I thought of that joke so many times while I was watching this movie. God damn it.
Oh, who up playing with They Worm? Who up avoiding They Worm?
One of those pervasive terminally online things.
Yeah. So I have to ask you, do you have a significant other?
Yeah.
Are they terminally online?
No.
Okay, my wife is the same exact way. She knows nothing about, like, who up playing with They Worm, so whenever I hit her with this stuff, she'll just be like, you can put your phone down. You can watch this movie with me. And I'm like,
But then you're gonna miss discourse.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, how often do you hit your significant other with just whatever the brain worm of the day?
I usually do a daily digest of sorts.
That is really cool. Like, they get to experience all the trauma without having to live it.
Yeah, it works. There should always be one terminally online person in every relationship.
Yeah, yeah, you can't both be. You will fall apart.
There's gotta be balance.
Double the chance of one of you being the main character of the day. You can't have that.
Mood's a thing for cattle and love play, not fighting.
I'm sorry, Gurney.
Not sorry enough.
The next scene, what's crazy is, like, after you knock this kind of... what you could argue is a CGI mess, an endearing one, but a mess regardless. Paul fights one of those mechanical arms that, you know, took all the jobs away from Detroit auto plants. In hindsight, the fight scene, it's filmed real goofy. David Lynch isn't known for his combat in movies. But it, using practical effects, it, like, got the point across. It genuinely looked like that thing was going to stab and gut him.
Yeah, I like that it does seem like Paul might die a few times.
Oh, yeah, eight times.
Yeah, as the action is building. Like, it's cool that, at least before the full stakes of the prophecy and predestination are explained, like, it does seem like there is a chance that he's in real danger.
Yeah. A lot of this kind of feels Star Wars adjacent,
yeah,
to Luke Skywalker.
You know, it definitely has a lot in common with the narrative arc.
Yeah, it's you this creature of the system that's built to not only rebel against it, but control it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of that's kind of rooted in, like, air quotes, Western religious belief. You know, it's like, oh, you are the big special boy who is going to make the world right and just.
Mm-hmm.
But that also is, like, how storytelling works, unfortunately.
Yeah.
That's why no Marxist movies exist, I think.
Yeah, they can't step to the great man theory of history.
Yeah, and, like, as much as I hate great man theory, I've literally done it, like, 50 times this episode. That's, like, how beaten into me it is. Because I'm like, oh, Frank Herbert and David Lynch. And it's like, this is a crew of hundreds of people, and I'm only celebrating two. Good job, Mr. Movies. I'm revoking your title.
Some people that I want to shout out are these five extras with non-speaking roles who play Imperial Guards, who show up a couple times. You know what I'm talking about? There's five of them.
I think I do.
There's five of them. And they look like the kind of people that only David Lynch would put in his movies.
Oh.
It's just like those five guys.
Yeah.
They show up, I think, twice.
Yeah, they almost look like they belong in a Tim and Eric skit.
Yeah.
Like,
it's amazing.
Oh, it's so just... good.
No, I love that. I went back and rewound it. It was just like, look at these five, like, incredibly distinctive, probably character actors that I don't recognize from somewhere.
I love doing that with movies. It takes everything in me not to be a like an actor biography guy whenever I'm watching movies with my wife.
Yeah.
But, like, whenever you see those side characters, you gotta stop it. You gotta be like, mm-hmm, I want you looky his face. Look at it. It's like, all right, there's nine of us here. You can't keep doing this. Okay. Sadly hitting play. Speaking of side characters, how'd you feel about the man with the eyebrows?
I thought, well, which one? Because there were two eyebrow guys, right?
Yes. There's one of them looks like that guy from Epic Rap Battles of History.
Yeah.
And then the other one looks like, he looked exactly like him. I couldn't get that out of my head.
So the big problem I have is that a lot of American accents in sci-fi to me sound really goofy. So,
oh yeah.
So I kept having that issue with those guys, but I thought they were appropriately sinister and twitchy.
Yeah, it also features like an accent that's like dead, like a completely extinct one, which is that transatlantic accent.
Yes.
Which like half of this movie is guys with transatlantic accents, and that I don't know what year they died, but they're like gone. Like, they don't exist anymore. And it's, this movie, each time I hear that accent, it just feels like a relic of the past. But also in sci-fi movies, I don't know. There's something about, like, if you, like, heard someone from Boston in, like, a sci-fi movie, you'd be like, come on now.
The all Boston remake of Dune.
Yeah. I can't do a Boston accent. I wish I could.
Mark Wahlberg, executive producing.
Yeah. It's a Dune remake with the same pacing and characters as The Departed.
Yep.
Like, I really want to try a Boston accent, but, like, you're actually from that area-ish, and I'm just going to airball so hard, you're going to be like, you tried.
Yeah.
Good job.
Also, people will definitely get mad.
Oh, yeah. Like, there's worms over there. That's as close as I could get. What's funny about the world building in this movie is that it's exactly like the books in specifically one aspect, mm-hmm. which is that it just throws you into the flames and expects you to be okay with it, which yeah. I completely respect. I love that.
Yeah, it's not about hand-holding.
No, speaking of, phenomenal transition into the box. Yep. What was up with the hand box?
the hand box... I think that was the scene that when I made those two or three attempts to start doing, like, that was the scene that really got me, because again, I think that was the one that really drove home that, like, Paul could actually die. Like, he could meet his end.
With that weird fingertip hypodermic needle, like, up to his jugular, like,
yeah.
The logistics of this stuff is, like, so ridiculous, but, like, I mentioned this, like, later on in the notes, and I'm probably going to mention it again whenever I get to it, but, like, my favorite type of sci-fi is sci-fi that just has technology, and it doesn't matter how it works.
Yeah.
Who gives a shit? It's the implications, it's the consequences of it, or it's the complications of it that matters, and this movie is so explicit. Like, why does the hand box burn your hand away? Why does it make it all goopy? Why does it make it see through like a green screen, the transparency thing, like where you had like the AB switch on like those old TV control boards? It doesn't matter. It's the threat of death, and it conveys it in an incredibly creative way.
Yeah, it seems like there was a lot of technology that was very situational.
Yeah, and if I remember right, in the book it was like that, right?
They pretty much had technology for everything, so you're left wondering how many prior uses has the hand box had. Maybe it's better not to think about that.
Yeah.
Maybe let's not get into that.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's become hard.
Where is this hand box?
Where did I leave that thing? Let's go the did you see the girl on Twitter today that was, no, she, it was on Twitter, it was a, the video was on Twitter, but she was a TikTok girl where she was like, all right, so raise 10 fingers, and this is for the hardcore empaths who have like intense feelings for like the sufferings of everything, but absolutely have no regard for like your well-being or something like that. And I'm just imagining like an empath thinking about the box and like how many lives it's taken away and just being crippled by it.
The Bene Gesserit kind of operate on that principle.
Yeah.
That's what, like, a lot of people in the Dune universe.
Just, death is literally everywhere. Get the fuck over it.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa, 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 hold on, that's my son.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, one of the almost insurmountable challenges that David Lynch and everybody was facing is that you have this world where so many people have lost the ability to feel actual human feelings, and you have to work around that in a movie that people want to see.
Isn't it fun having to actually appeal to human emotions, but also drive American bloodlust in your movies? Because to make a blockbuster, you gotta do both. And isn't it funny how the DOD just kind of makes all our blockbusters now?
Yeah. Oh, my God. A DOD Dune.
Yeah, oh my God.
So depressing.
Oh, if only the American Air Force was here to drop lethal bomb resistance on these worms. God. Can you imagine it?
I mean, I watched the Snyder Cut. I can imagine.
They're like... like arming Raytheon branded missiles to find, like, label out like a Bud Light can.
Well, it's funny because, like, because some of these organizations are supposed to represent OPEC, and you know, actual at the time that he wrote it, organizations that were shaping geopolitics.
That makes a lot of sense, because I mean, like, the environmental angles for this almost feel incredibly obvious, but at the same time, I had no clue what they were representing. But I mean, like, three massive bodies controlling access to a vital resource that's only from a desert area.
Yeah,
that is pretty obvious now that I think about it.
Yeah, it's both very, very reflective of the late 60s, early 70s, and also now.
Damn.
Very, very, very depressing in its own way.
So I wonder what that, what was it? Was it Libya in the early 70s when we had that huge spike in the price of oil?
Yeah.
What happened to Frank Herbert? Like, personally, was he okay?
Probably not.
Just on his knees screaming, "The spice," just watching Fox Business, like, on TV.
My flesh popping off
here.
No woman, child, ever withstood that much. Take your hand out of the box and look at it, young human.
I bet you aren't expecting this to be a two-part episode. We've never done a two-part episode here in the Mr. Movies podcast. Life is an adventure, and much like the Dune series, this really, really needed to be a two-part thing. It's really hard to say everything that you want to say in just one part. Could this be ill tidings? Could this be something bad, boding, brewing on the horizon, like a dust storm or a worm? It's probably a worm. Because as we've established in the beginning of this podcast episode, worms are all up in your shit now. See you next week, and beware of the worm.